Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Welcome to another edition of the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Rob Giannino, and we're coming to you from the road. That's right, Tyler and I are on a 21-day epic coast-to-coast father-son fly fishing road trip that takes us all the way from Boston to California and back. Our first stop was in Wyoming, where we fished the Savory Creek, and that was a blast. Our next big stop is going to be in California, where we're going to fish in the Sierra Nevadas for the beautiful yet elusive golden trout. We're fishing with golden trout pack trains, and I'm being joined by Mikey Weir of Caltrout. Who's Caltrout? Well, stay tuned for this episode of the podcast because we'll have both Mikey and Megan of Caltrout, and it's going to be a really fun episode. Before we jump in, I do want to say a special word of thanks to Douglas Fly Fishing. They've provided us an incredible fly fishing vehicle to take on this 21-day epic road trip. Along with that, a full quiver of fly rods for demo and use, and they've been awesome. Before we jump into the podcast, I do want to thank our sponsors.
Bissell Insurance, Norvice, and The Fly Fishing Show. What do I love about Bissell Insurance? Well, they are the only insurance agency endorsed by AFTA, the American Fly Fishing Trade Association. If you're a business, a lodge, or a guide in the fly fishing or outdoor industry, you really want to give Art at Bissell Insurance a call. You can find them at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. After using my Norvice for almost a year now, I can easily see why it's called the most innovative fly tying system on the market. When people come by the booth at the fly fishing show and see my Norvice, they love it. Either they have one and want to talk about it, or they really want to get one. Some of the main advantages of the Norvice is not only does it rotate, but it fully spins, making your fly tying more efficient and often faster. To check out the Norvice, some online videos, and have access to their online store, visit nor-vice.com. Now let's head to the podcast.
All right, thanks. We're back here at the California Show, and I'm excited to have the group here from California Trout, also known as Caltrout. We have both Megan Wynn and Mikey Weir on the podcast. Guys, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Rob, for having us.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Before we get into all this cool stuff, we want to talk about California Trout and your organization. I know I recognize you, Mikey, because I saw you last year on the IF4. You were the ambassador for the whole film festival last year. Plus, you have a movie in tonight's premiere in California.
Yeah, I've been working with the IF4 for a number of years now. Kind of helped them get going initially and been working with them ever since. Caltrout hosts several screenings now.
We got 7 booked and more to come soon.
Yeah, so it's turned into a great way to engage our audience here. It's a great fundraiser that helps support our conservation activities, and just a great way to bring anglers together, have a good time, have a great night, watch some films.
Yeah.
And so this year I got a great film about Maxine McCormick, a young casting phenom who won the World Casting Fly Championship at 12 years old, beat the best in the world, beat Steve Rajeff and these, you know, incredible casters at 12. And then came back and did it again 2 years later at 14, proved that, you know, it wasn't just a fluke, and she's here to stay. And it's a great little documentary kind of illustrating the really inspirational story of this young lady. She's awesome.
I'm excited to see that. I was at the last premiere, but you said it wasn't actually in Lynnwood. Tonight is the premiere of the whole show in the world.
I believe so, yeah. First time on the big screen.
That's very cool. And then why don't you tell us real quickly about your film from last year's film festival?
Yeah, last year I did a film about fly fishing for peacock bass in the Amazon. I did it with Rob Anderson. He's just next door here. You know, I really took on the story to kind of illustrate the benefits of ecotourism in protecting resources. And so Rob has a lease on 90 miles of river in the Amazon. And through this fishing lease, he's able to protect that land. Basically, they pay the local village to come there and fish. And so in return, they keep it natural and pristine as opposed to resource extraction, logging and mining and other activities, commercial fishing that would take place in the Amazon. And so you know, it's a story about going and catching fish and having a cool adventure, but really the underlying theme is just this, the way that ecotourism can protect resources, and that's really kind of become a model, you know, that supports this local village. Kids have more opportunities to get an education, to get, you know, the stuff that they want,
yeah,
electronics, and but they are able to do it through actually protecting the resources through ecotourism, through catch and release fishing. You come, catch some fish, you let them go. When the group of anglers leaves at the end of the week, the resource is the same as it was at the start of the week.
Yeah.
And they get to make money off it and you know, fuel their economy in this really remote area and protecting one of the most valuable ecosystems on the planet. So pretty cool to catch a bunch of fish and have one of the best fishing experiences on planet Earth, and also know that it's for a good cause.
Yeah, we need that right now in the Amazon, because it's a lot of it's going away quick.
Yeah, that was the thing, is we went to the river and they had a big fire there 2 years prior, and you know, that was unprecedented for that area in the yeah. Amazon to have a forest fire like that, an out of control fire. And so to see that firsthand, and then, you know, last year to see all the fires happen in the Amazon, it really hit home how much climate change is affecting that area.
Yeah, and we're also seeing that up in the OP, Olympic Peninsula. We just came from there, and you know, to see the clear cuts, it's crazy. You know, and you're talking about, you know, national forests, and they're just cutting it down.
And we've been through that in California, and that's you know, luckily we've had a lot of reform down here in our logging practices, but it, you know, it's been a hard thing on our watersheds, and that's one of the things that we're still, you know, working on, the compounding long-term effects of those on our ecosystem. So
yeah, well, very cool. Thanks for giving us those overviews of your shows, and I can't wait to see the one tonight.
Sweet.
It's going to be fun. And we do want to get into that couch out, because part of the podcast initiative this year is to talk about more local organizations, to see what you guys are doing here on the home front in California, how you guys are protecting the fisheries. And Megan, what would you say the purpose of couch out is?
Yeah, so Caltrout is a wild fisheries conservation organization, and our mission is to ensure that we have resilient wild fish thrive in these healthy rivers and healthy waters for a better California now and for future generations.
And you mentioned that wild. I mean, that's such a, you know, it's such a buzzword today, because when you're trying to protect fisheries, having it be wild is so crucial. So where do you guys stand on, like, stalking? Let's just come right out and ask.
Well, we say wild fish because we believe fish are an indicator species of the health of a watershed.
Okay.
So if we can protect water at its source for people and fish to enjoy, it's good enough for the rest of the environment and have a balance between those resources. We say in our tagline, fish, water, people. We believe those are our three priorities and the resources that we want to protect.
Yeah, I mean, we're not involved in stocking. You know, our mission isn't to increase fish numbers by putting more fish in the water. Our concern is protecting the sustainability of our native fish mm-hmm. resources. So the, you know, in my view, the true heritage of this landscape is our diversity of native fishes that we have here. That's what we're really trying to protect, is the remaining genetics of our native trout species, and then the health, you know, of self-sustaining wild runs of salmon and steelhead. And that's really our mission, is not to enhance fisheries just for fishing by putting more fish into them. It's to enhance the ecosystem so it supports more fish naturally and sustainably. So that's kind of where that wild element comes into play.
I love that. Mikey, when was Cal Trout created, and by who?
Yeah, so the organization was officially signed in 1971. And so we're coming up on our 50th anniversary here. And it was basically created by a group of passionate anglers that really wanted to see some change happen in California. And it started with the first wild trout project on the West Coast. I think maybe the first actual wild trout project in America on Hat Creek. And it was a group of anglers that used to be part of Trout Unlimited, but kind of had a falling out or didn't agree necessarily with the direction that organization wanted to go. And so they branched off to do their own thing. And so most of the original Caltrout founders were from the Bay Area, San Francisco and Greater Bay Area. And they broke off and formed Caltrout to restore Hat Creek, which was a very historical and traditional fishery here. And there was certain things they wanted out of it. So they initially blocked off Hat Creek, made a barrier, cleaned out all the rough fish and non-natives, and then let it repopulate with wild fish and manage it as a wild trout fishery. And through that came these angling ethics of catch and release, and which was an unheard of concept back there. It was a radical concept in the 70s. And now you look at that in the sport of fly fishing, it's just ingrained in what we do now. It's part of our culture, and that was started right here, you know, on Hat Creek through California trout. And then from there, we branched out and took on a couple really historical court cases, helped rewater Mono Lake by suing Department of Power and Water from LA, getting water back in Mono Lake. That was a really historic thing. We were instrumental in passing the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in the mid-70s, which has protected, you know, multiple rivers across the West Coast and all the United States. And so there's a lot of history that's kind of unknown about the organization, really unsung heroes back in the day that have set us up for future generations to come. And so it's kind of cool to honor that heritage of the organization from the past, and then now all this innovative stuff that we're working on moving forward. So it's always been about future generations and enhancing our fisheries and sustainable fisheries. And so we're trying to honor that legacy.
That's very cool. Tell me about the structure of the organization as far as like leaders and meetings and, you know, how you guys run your business.
We are a total staff of 30 people here in California, and we have 6 regional offices spread out throughout the state. We have a North Coast office, Sierra Meadows, Headwaters, South Coast. We got Shasta, Mount Klamath, a Bay Area region, and our Central Valley. So that makes up our offices that we have. And I would say our organization is, you know, we're a small team, but we're lean and quick, and we can really get the job done. And I think that kind of puts us at an advantage because we are state-run and we can make these quick decisions without having, you know, a national organization kind of telling us what we need. And California's water issues are so unique to our geography, especially our rivers. Everybody has their different expertise. Even within California, our regions, like the Central Valley, is way different from what you would expect in the Sierras. So there's a lot of diversity within the work that we do, but it's we all work together. It's common and seen in our strategies that we could talk about later.
Yeah.
So we have our head office is in San Francisco, and then we are kind of our working model is to embed ourselves in the key geographies where we feel we can do the most good. And so it was very strategic moves as to where we put our offices or where we can, being a small organization, we want to be where we can have the most impact on native salmonids. And so those are kind of the locations we've chosen. I mean, California's a big state. There's a ton of work to be done. And everybody always says, as an organization, we're punching above our weight class because we get a lot of work done for the size of organization we are. And people say that all the time.
You guys are nonprofit?
We're a nonprofit.
Very cool. Megan, you talked about like 32 species of trout or salmonoids that you support. Can you give us kind of an overview?
Yeah, so in California, we have 32 native salmonids, actually 31 that are living. Now the bull trout in California has been extinct. But what we did in partnership with the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences was created the SOS report, which stands for Save Our Salmonids Scientific Report. And it documents all of these species of trout, salmon, and steelhead in California, and has found that climate change is the overarching threat to all our salmonids, and they're not doing so great. Spoiler alert, about 45% of all salmonids will be extinct in the next 50 years if present trends continue, we don't do anything about it. And so this scientific document has become our guiding principle and how we approach all our work. It's all based in science, and we have clear priorities on how to restore these fisheries.
And you talked about in that SOS report, there was some fish in hot water.
Mm-hmm.
Can you notate a couple of the fish that are more trouble than others?
Yeah, well, off the top of my head, southern steelhead are definitely one of the endangered species that we're focusing a lot of our efforts in Southern California right now to remove fish passage barriers. One of their big projects right now is the I-5 Chabuco Creek barrier removal. There's this creek that runs underneath the freeway, and we just got a big grant from CFW for the Prop 1 to remove that barrier by widening the channel and letting southern steelhead move towards where they historically spawn, and that will definitely boost their population.
How far have steelhead historically spawned? How far south?
Yeah, I mean, steelhead, historic, were all the way down into Baja, California.
Really?
You know, in modern times. And they still run the entire California coast. We have creeks we work in all the way down in San Diego County. We have an office in San Diego, and there still are adult steelhead returning to those rivers every year.
Mm.
Unfortunately, numbers are pretty small, and there isn't really great monitoring, but... You know, we do get documentation of fish all the way down in San Diego County.
What are the five key strategies you had told me about, Megan?
Yeah, so these five key strategies are called Protect the Best. And this initiative is to protect fisheries that already are abundant, like Hat Creek we mentioned, like the Eagle River, the strongholds where abundant trout population exists. So we want to make sure we keep it that way. The other initiatives are integrate wild fish and working landscapes. So that's working with farmers, such as in the Central Valley, so that we have water that works for both farmers and fish. So it's kind of finding those win-win situations and best case scenarios for them.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Oh yeah, it is.
And just that one initiative alone sounds like a ton of work.
It is, but we have some awesome floodplain science that just came out of it, and we've discovered that fish food grows 150 times faster on a floodplain than it does on the river. Because if you imagine a floodplain like a solar panel, the water spreads out over these fields and the sun warms up the water, creates all this energy, this life. It grows all these bugs, and fish love bugs. That's what they eat. And yeah, it just becomes an all-you-can-eat buffet for these fish. And they get really fat and they eat a lot, and then they're ready to go out into the rivers and into the ocean. And we've seen that fish that get fatter are more likely to survive in the ocean than those who are, you know, skinny.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you actually have people like working with the farmers? You guys go to like a farmers union, or is there like a group that you talk to on behalf of all the farmers, or do you just go farmer by farmer?
A little of both. I mean, we work in a larger scale through the Central Valley Salmon Habitat Partnership, where we have multiple stakeholders that come to the table, including, you know, representatives from ag in general.
Yeah.
And then we do have specific farmers that work with us, that we have projects on their properties. And that list is growing every year. We started with one test plot in a place called Nags Ranch. A guy gave us a little portion of his rice field to do our experiments in the winter. We proved that we put baby salmon, we call it the Nigiri Project, fish over rice. So we take the flooded rice fields. Historically, they used to burn the stubble off the fields in the wintertime and early spring. Now they flood the fields, which burns the stubble. And they realize that when they flood these fields, there's all these bugs in the soil that just come up and explode. But the water needs to be on the floodplain for at least a couple weeks. You know, 3 weeks, right, we start to get the best growth. 4 or 5 weeks, you have this explosion of food. And if we put baby salmon on there, they grow 6 times faster in these floodplain fields than they do in the river. But what's happened is all of California's rivers have been levied off, and so we've disconnected fish's ability to naturally access these floodplains. The whole Central Valley used to be a giant floodplain. So we've cut off 99% of that habitat. There's one river left with a wild floodplain in the entire Central Valley. And so we're working with the state of California to upgrade our infrastructure so that we can get wild fish onto the floodplains naturally.
Yep.
And back off, specifically in the bypass areas of the Sacramento River. And then we're also working with farmers. We realize that we're not going to be able to get wild fish onto the floodplains in the scale that we need, in the time we need. So now we're working with farmers to flood their fields, grow this fish food, and then pump it back into the river so that fish that are in the river have access to this food without having or being able to get onto the floodplain. And so now we have several partners. Every year, these farmers are seeing us working with their neighbor, with the other farmer. They're seeing what we're doing, and it's working. And they're like, this is really cool. We want to be part of this. And so it's spiraling.
It's growing.
Last year, we did 5,000 acres of fields flooded and food pumped back in. And this year, I think we're doubling that. We've got a whole another ranch that they gave us to do experiments on. So it's really spiraling and turning into what's going to be, you know, some catastrophic change moving forward.
Do you ever run into any issues that are on the farm running into the rivers that you wouldn't naturally want running in the rivers, like maybe like pesticides or...
Yeah, and that's an issue, but the reality is that's going to happen anyway.
I was going to say
that. They're
going
to flood these fields and pump that stuff back into the river no matter what.
Yeah.
And so we're working with the ag operators to flood the fields at the right time to grow the optimal amount of food and to leave the water there the optimal time for the food and then to pump it back in at the best times for the fish.
Yeah.
And so that's where we come in with the science to help dictate their operations and in a way that's more beneficial to the water sitting on the fields longer, we found is really beneficial for the birds. So we got Ducks Unlimited, and we've got these other organizations coming in that are working with us on that side of it.
Yeah.
So it's better for the farmers, it's better for the birds, it's better for the fish. And, you know, it's really that those projects are a win-win for everybody. And that's what we like, is these multiple stakeholder projects that are just good all around for
help
the
grow everything.
Yeah.
Everything's connected.
Megan, I'm sorry I cut you off on that farmer one.
That's
okay. That was number two. What was the others?
Yeah, so we've got three more to go. The next one is Reconnect Habitat. And so that is working to remove obsolete dams, ones that are no longer functioning for any purpose. They've just obsolete, collecting dust, literally. And to provide volitional fish passage for salmon and steelhead. And so the big projects that we're working on for that is removing Klamath Dams. That's a huge four dam that are on the Klamath River right now. And by removing them, that'll open up 300 miles to amazing critical spawning and rearing habitat for salmon.
And steelhead too, right?
And steelhead,
yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
The Klamath is a great steelhead river.
It's an amazing steelhead river for summer steelhead and winter steelhead, and then all five species of Pacific salmon as well.
So yeah, I had a guy by the booth earlier, and he was showing me some pictures of, he said he got 22 steelhead in 2 days.
Yeah.
Wow.
Last week in the Klamath.
Yeah.
With the guide.
Yeah. And, you know, right now that kind of phenomenon happens because the lower dams kind of stack the fish up. There's a lot of fish that want to move further upriver, and now they all kind of get stopped at the dam, and so it's easy pickings for fishermen. And so that's, in the short term, it's kind of a fun fishery, but in the long term, the whole system's going to be a lot more viable when those fish are able to access that additional, it's actually way over 300 miles of habitat, and get back into their historical range. And the Klamath is such an amazing system that cuts all the way from the eastern basin of Oregon through the coastal mountains all the way to the ocean, and the diversity of habitats in between is just phenomenal, and being able to get fish back into those habitats is going to be really critical for the long-term survival of wild salmonids, you know, in California in the face of climate change. And so it's going to be a really cool project, and removing those four main stem dams is going to be the biggest river restoration project in the history of probably the world. It's going to be really incredible to see that happening in the next few years.
Do we have a time frame when the first one start? Are they going to all go at the same time, or are you going to domino them?
They're taking them all down simultaneously starting 2022. So it's coming up quick. We're just right now in the process of pushing through all the permits and allocating the funding in the right areas. We already have a contractor hired that's going to do the construction. I'm going to be helping document that process and you know, making a movie to tell that story about this really historical time.
Is there a budget?
Yeah, you can go on KRRC's website. They have it all outlined.
KlamathRenewal.org.
Yeah, and the money's already there. It's already been set aside. Part of it, a big chunk of it, was paid by the ratepayers. They put an extra 5 or 10 cents on people's bills for the last 20 years. I mean, the company knew that they had to have some kind of mitigation strategy moving forward, either retrofit those dams or remove them. And really, it came down to the best alternative for the power generating company was to remove the dams in the long run.
Yep.
And so they're allocating most of the funds. And yeah, so the funds are there. But we live in California. It's one of the most litigious places on planet Earth. So we're just going through the permitting and, you know,
lawyers are involved.
The mitigation of, like, you know, compensating people that have land there and the different, you know, things that need to happen to make it all fall into place.
So the next one we got is steward source water areas. So that's protecting water at its source. And 60% of our water in California comes from the Sierra Nevada. And our focus here is really on meadow restoration up there.
Okay.
And healthy meadows, if you didn't know this, they kind of function as sponges, and they absorb the cold, clean water that is melted from the Sierra Nevada snowcap, and the meadows kind of hold it and release it slower and later on in the year, so that we have this cold, clean water later in the hotter summer months, which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
And a great kind of system before it gets to the Central Valley and things like that. It's really another one of our partnership. It's the Sierra Meadows Partnership, which is a vast team of scientists from all different universities. But it's a really takes a huge effort, because there's just like over 50 or 80,000 acres of meadows, and 50% of them are degraded. So it's going to take a lot of work to kind of restore them. And there's a bunch of different methods. There's a cool one called the beaver dam analog, which is to create these pseudo beaver dams out of willow trees and to kind of mimic what beavers would normally do, but they're now extinct in California. So we would just kind of mimic that kind of system. And kind of pull the water and hold it back later. But yeah, definitely a team effort for sure.
Very cool. And the last one?
Yeah, the last one is restore estuaries. So restoring the function where we have the land and sea interface, juvenile salmon can rear there and get bigger before they head out into the ocean.
Yep.
And one of the big projects we're working on is Pescadero Marsh right now, which is near the Bay Area. We are tagging and monitoring fish sizes over there, seeing how many fish come through this area and if it's a good source to start our restoration projects.
Yeah, we're working on a multitude of estuaries across the state, and they're just, you know, estuaries have been kind of an overlooked habitat historically, and so a lot of our estuaries along the California coast have been degraded. They've either been levied to make room for farmland or, you know, pushed tighter than they should be because of roads and stuff. We got highways that transect a lot of our coastline in California, and so we're really realizing that what a critical nexus that is for these salmonids. That's the area where they go through smoltification when they're leaving the river to acclimatize themselves to salt water. And then also when they come out of the ocean as adults, they have to go through a metaphysical change to go from salt water to fresh water, which is really a miracle of nature in and of itself, the way that salmonids can do this. And specifically steelhead, when salmon go through that metaphysical change coming back into the river, it's the end of their life cycle. They're going to die. But steelhead can do this multiple times. It can go between freshwater and saltwater, and that estuary is where that kind of change takes place. And it's really incredible just to think that a fish can do that. You know, there's very few organisms on earth that can do that, and a steelhead can do it so quickly and seamlessly to go from salt to fresh. So we're really trying to help restore and bolster our estuaries. There's places where we're working on pulling back levees to make estuaries bigger. There's places where we're doing riparian restoration work. There's places where we're retrofitting floodgates so that fish, because a lot of our estuaries, especially on the North Coast, have been blocked by these one-way floodgates so that fresh water drains out and salt water can't get back in, and that protects pastures where people have livestock and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so we want to be able to retrofit these gates so that native salmonids can get back into this floodplain habitat on the peripheries of these estuaries. And so there's a multitude of work going on there. And then also the implications for carbon sequestration, you know, having these healthy marine wetlands as well as inland wetlands, and, you know, the way they sequester carbon and just kind of filter and keep that ecosystem healthy. And so reconnecting those systems is just as important as reconnecting and, you know, having viable habitat in the rivers themselves.
Mikey, I forgot to ask you, what is your role, like what is your position, your title with the organization?
Yeah, so I'm the storyteller. I'm kind of the rover for Caltrout. I get to go and check out all our different projects and help tell the stories. So kind of do that through a multimedia approach. Obviously do a lot of videos that help get our stories out there to the public, to our constituents, to our members, take photos that we use in our marketing, write articles for magazines and for our publications, and then do events like this, come out and tell people about it. And so I have seen just about all of Caltrout's projects, been driving up and down the state for several years now and helping bring this, you know, sometimes nerdy science-based conservation work out to the public in a way that they can, you know, digest it and realize how it relates to either better fishing or healthy functioning ecosystems and ecosystem services. So really getting the word out about all the great work that Caltrout's doing.
Podcasting. Hey, we're all podcasting now, right?
Pro podcaster.
Before we talk about some of your success stories, because we have a couple that we want to mention, what are some of the major challenges? I know you've talked about that with climate change and fires. What are some of the major challenges trout face in California today?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple factors, you know. A lot of the stressors are outlined in our SOS, our Status of Salmonids report. And, you know, climate change is obviously a big one, which affects salmonids in a multitude of ways. They're very temperature-dependent, temperature-sensitive organisms that rely on cold, clean water. You know, any bit of warming trends is going to affect salmonids in a major way. And then that also relates to fires. You know, fires have a huge impact on salmonids up in the Sierras, you know, especially our isolated and, you know, native populations of red bands and golden trout and cutthroat that are very sensitive. And then pollution, overpopulation, ag practices, logging, you know, there's all kinds of factors that can negatively stress our native salmonids. And so we really use that Status of Salmonids Fish and Hot Water report as kind of a guiding document. And for each species, we outline what the stressors are and what some of the solutions will be to help maintain healthy populations moving forward. And so we really use that as kind of our guiding light for our working model these days to multitude of species across the board.
Yeah, and there's some great maps in the report as well that show their historical range, that where the span of these fish used to be, and you can see how they've shrunk over time because of these threats as well.
Yeah.
Fun fact, I also made those maps.
Yeah, I was going to say your collateral is outstanding. I came by your booth and your maps. I love the way how you guys have everything mapped out, and in your collateral that you send out to your members is phenomenal. So kudos on that. What are some of the success stories that you guys have had recently?
Yeah, we recently mentioned the NAGS project, which is our Central Valley projects, Klamath Dams. We just recently got almost a $5 million grant through CDFW through Prop 1. So that was a voter approved proposition, which is great because it goes to show that the people really have a voice and say in what we do. And we're just so grateful for our supporters.
So California Department of Fish and Wildlife?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that earmarked for anything specifically? Or
it was through Prop 1. So Prop 1, one of that is for fish resiliency and water protection. And so through that, we got approval.
Yeah, it comes out of water security, basically. Our work is partly funded by grants, state and federal, partly funded by private foundations and donors, and then partly funded by our members. And when we do get grants, they are allocated for specific projects. That when we get grant money, that grant money is for a very specific part of a very specific project. So we can't spend it on whatever we want. It has to go to that project. Whereas money that comes in from private foundations and from our members, we have a little more leniency with what we can do with that money. So it's a little more unrestricted in how we can spend it and the way, you know, we can approach things. But definitely when we get grants, it's for a very specific project. So we just got a grant to retrofit the barrier at I-5 at Tribuco Creek. That's a big one. And then we're building a bridge that's going to help with fish access on the Santa Margarita River. So we're taking out an old, funky, antiquated crossing and putting in a bridge. It's a huge project. I think that's like a $13 million project that we're embarking on over the next few years. And so typically we get grants for each phase of the project. You got planning, you got permitting, and then you got implementation. And then once you start a project, it kind of spirals and goes. And,
yeah.
And yeah, there's been a ton of great success stories. I mean, we just last year completed a 6-year restoration design on Hat Creek, a place that we've been working since the start of California trout.
Yep.
That was a multi-million dollar project, working with the tribes, working with locals, you know, working with PG&E, working with CDFW. So again, just bringing these multiple stakeholders together to achieve really meaningful impact, you know, noticeable, measurable impact. And that's kind of what we're going for.
For the listeners who aren't familiar with Hat Creek, can you kind of give them a geographic understanding of where it is and the fishery?
Yeah, Hat Creek is a beautiful spring-fed river. It's in what they call the Intermountain region, which is kind of east of Redding. Hat Creek kind of nestled between Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, our two big volcanoes here in California. Such a vast landscape and diversity of geology in California, you know, from the Sierras to the Shasta to the North Coast to the, you know, Central Valley, the desert. It's all just a totally different geography. And so each one of our regions is very different. Hat Creek's a beautiful spring-fed river. It does have some hydro projects on it, places where PG&E pumps water around in flumes, pumps it back into powerhouses to generate electricity. And so our main restoration area is below one of those powerhouses, Powerhouse 2 on Hat Creek. And that flows down into Lake Britton, which is part of the Pitt River system, one of the biggest power generation systems in California, multiple dams and hydro projects in that system. And so we worked with PG&E originally and the biologists from CDFW, and that partnership has held together for almost 50 years now, keeping an eye on that fishery. But Caltrout's really been the guiding light that for the fish, you know, for keeping that fish component healthy. Hat Creek went through a hard phase where it fell through kind of a hard time. It was like one of the best fisheries in California. Everybody went there. Very, you know, well-known fishery. There was multiple fly shops that revolved just around that fishery, you know, in the Burney area. And then it kind of went through a decline and people kind of forgot about Hat Creek for a while. And really it was Caltrout that came back to it and said, hey, what can we do to address some of these projects? And then so we started with some restoration work in 2004, 2005, and then came back, and under the leadership of Drew Braw, our Shasta programs manager these days, he put together this large-scale restoration design and it's really had a measurable effect. You go to Hat Creek now, and the fishery's bustling again. There's fish all over the place.
What kind of fish?
Mostly rainbow trout. There are, Hat Creek is 90%+ native rainbows. There are a few brown trout in the system, and their numbers have actually boosted a bit in the last few years. Starting to see some big browns again, including every once in a while some really big browns. But primarily, it's a rainbow trout fishery, native rainbow trout.
Who are your members? Like, describe who a member would be, Megan.
Our members historically used to be anglers. You know, we mentioned our history from Hat Creek Fishery. But I believe it's grown to be anyone who enjoys wild rivers. We have a conservationist audience now, especially with our scientific report. But I would say our audience is anyone who enjoys the outdoors and healthy rivers and wants to see healthy fish and healthy waters for now and future generations to come.
Yeah, I mean, really, it started out as angling and an angling advocacy group, and we've grown to tackle so much more than that. So many big issues revolving around water in California. So it's really about cold water ecosystems and the ecosystem services they provide to all living organisms. You know, it's better for all fish and wildlife. It's better for people to have a healthy environment, and ultimately it's, you know, better for our economy and all the aspects of our life here in California to have healthy waterways. And so once you really dive in and take a deeper look at what the organization's doing beyond just angling, I think that, you know, the work we're doing could appeal to just about everybody if they knew more about what we're doing.
For sure. In addition to kind of just supporting the projects in the organization itself, are there member benefits that a member has if they become a member of your organization?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the money you contribute is huge for us. Like I said, that's the unrestricted funds that allow us the flexibility to be able to take on projects as they come up. Not just be allocated to certain things that we have to do, but, you know, if there's a critical threat that comes up, it's really that membership money that allows us to move in those directions and tackle those things that happen spontaneously. You know, it's a big part of this. We have a big fire and, you know, we have a fish kill or we have something happens. We need to be able to have the flexibility to do that. But as far as becoming a member of Caltrout, yeah, you get access to a ton of information. We hit you with, you know, we don't overload our members with a bunch of crap and emails every week, you know, but you get just a good amount of information that if you're someone that wants knowledge, we're going to provide that to you. And we do that through videos. We have a quarterly online magazine that comes out, the Current magazine. So as a member, you get access to that. It's full of great videos. We put out a ton of great videos for marketing purposes. You'll get access to those. And then, you know, we have spot checks on different fisheries. We have updates on, you know, projects that we're doing, ways that people can get involved. So if there's ever a vote, you know, or a petition that you can sign, or sometimes we have, you know, volunteer opportunities where people can get out in the field. And then also we have, you know, trips that we take. We do guide trips for our donors and stuff like that. So you get access to that. We have a trout camp that people that come in at certain levels have access to. We own some property on the Upper Sacramento River. And then we also partner with tons of different guide services and lodge. And so we can offer these really cool and exclusive fishing trips to some of the really prime fisheries in California. So another reason to kind of follow along with us here.
So besides these guide trips, do you guys get together at all?
We do. We host a ton of events, too. Like this year, we're doing the IF4 series. That's a great way to bring people together. We also do other film festivals. We do tons of different little events in all of our regions, you know, around that you'll, you know, be invited to as a member and get to come, you know, gather as a community and either see the work we're doing or, you know, talk about the projects coming up. And so, yeah, it's a great community to be part of because, you know, anybody you meet through Caltrout's going to be into rivers, into, you know, wild places and, you know, have a common thread, you know, stuff to talk about. It's a great community, you know.
I love that. I want to become a member.
You should.
Yeah.
I'm coming over.
Come Absolutely. Over. We'll sign you up.
Yes, for sure. What is the cost of a membership?
The cost at its base level is $35.
Okay, easy enough.
Yeah, and it can just go up from there. And if you are feeling really involved, we have the Golden Trout Circle, which is our $1,000 level above, and that'll give you access to trout camp and a bunch of other great perks. But definitely part of the membership circle.
So yeah, so basically you have your basic membership and then, you know, donations and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is every year. A lot of people sign up once and forget. They think, hey, I'm a Caltrout member for life. But
lifetime membership for $35.
Every year we would ask you to renew, and really the best level for us is the people that sign up for monthly giving. You know, if you can give, you know, $5 $5 a month or $10 a month. I mean, it's really, it seems like a small amount, but it's huge for us. It's monumental for us, especially to have that continued giving that we can count on. So yeah. I really try to encourage that monthly giving.
Very cool. And so if you're not at a show or see you guys in person and sign up right there, how can somebody sign up, maybe online even?
Caltrout.org.
Check us out, Caltrout.org. We're also on social media. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, yeah. Twitter, and even LinkedIn.
Before I close, guys, I got to get your take because we were talking about Steelhead, Wild Steelhead. And, you know, being from
my
the
favorite.
East, yes. Being from the East Coast is this big debate. Is the trout or the steelhead in the Great Lakes steelhead, or, you know, like to say in the Pacific Northwest, they are not steelhead. So I got some clarification when I did a podcast in Linwood with a fish biologist. So I have a better understanding now. But Mikey, since we've been talking about the steelhead, I'd like to hear your take on this whole debate.
I mean, personally, I would say a steelhead has been to the salt, and that's what makes a steelhead. You know, all rainbows have the genetics of steelhead in them. They all have the desire to run to a body of water and get big and come back up to a river.
Yep.
And so we see that a ton in California, where we have a bunch of my favorite fisheries are lake running fish, where they have access to a big lake they can go down to, get big, and then come back in the river and you can catch them.
Yeah.
And a lot of those trout are the size of steelhead, and you could call them a steelhead. But to me, I think the distinction would be if a rainbow trout has been to the salt and gone through that metamorphic change and then come back into a river, you know.
Very cool.
That's a true steelhead.
I love that. Because you kind of clarified and even put a stamp on what the fish biologist up in Linwood told me, and that a steelhead is basically just a rainbow trout. And see, from the East Coast, I kind of thought that a steelhead was actually a different species of fish than a rainbow trout. But it's the exact same species, and it's just what it does with its life determines what it is, or what bucket, if you will.
Yep.
So you have your resident rainbows.
Yeah.
You could be born of a steelhead and become a resident rainbow.
A steelhead is just a rainbow that's been to the ocean.
Yeah.
And that's what's really cool about rainbow trout / steelhead is they have the greatest diversity of life histories of any other salmonid. That's why they are super highly adaptable animals. And so what's cool is, you know, say in Southern California, where there aren't a ton of steelhead left, an adult steelhead can come out of the ocean. Say a female adult runs out of a creek in Southern California, goes to the ocean, and 2 years into the ocean, it decides it wants to come back and spawn. It goes up to its creek, and the mouth of that creek is blocked, or there isn't enough water. We're having a drought year. It goes and waits out in the ocean another year. It comes back. Nope, conditions aren't right. It goes back again. That fish might be out there 5-6 years. Comes back into a creek at 35 inches, lays 10,000 eggs, and it might not find a mate. And a resident rainbow that has been in that creek for 2 years could potentially, you know, seed those eggs from that steelhead and create a whole nother cohort of these animals. And then they have this amazing ability to adapt to climatic stressors and influencers and change their life histories. And so a salmon, they're programmed to all do the same thing. Eggs are laid in the river. They all go out in a big wave at the same time. They all swim around together in the ocean, do the same thing. They all come back at the same time with a little bit of variation and coming in different waves and stuff and different timing runs. But they all kind of do the same thing. Whereas a steelhead, this female steelhead from the ocean could spawn with a resident trout, lay 10,000 eggs. 5,000 of those might stay in the river their whole lives. 5,000 of them might go to the estuary and rear. And then of the ones that go to the estuary, half of them might go to the ocean on a big rain event. Half of them might go back up the river.
Yeah.
The ones that are up the river might go to the estuary and decide not to go to the ocean, then go back up the river.
Yeah.
The ones that are in the estuary might decide to go out to the ocean, might decide not to go out to the ocean. It's really amazing. And just through those strategies, they have a great amount of adaptability to climatic changes. And so really with steelhead, they are the kind of the field of dreams fish. You give them the habitat, they're going to make use of it. And so that's a big part of our working model, is just allow them the conditions to naturally be able to go through these changes. You know, whereas like hatchery fish are kind of the same deal, where they're just programmed to have one life history. You know, they want to release them all at the same time. They want them to go down at the same time. They want them to come back at the same time because it's a lot easier for them to manage.
Yep.
Whereas like, that's why we need to keep these wild genetics in the gene pool, because they have the adaptability to react to climatic stressors and changes. And then also the other super critically important component to maintaining wild fish stocks, in my mind, is the ability for wild fish to select their own mates. And so when you have a hatchery program, they just take a bunch of fish, indiscriminately spawn them together, create an army of clones and send them back out. Whereas in the wild, fish select their own mates for very specific traits. And really, you know, a lot of times the dominant big female is going to be courted by the biggest, most dominant male, and he's going to push away all the chasers and fertilize the majority of her eggs. But then there's always a little sneaky male jack or something that'll get in there and fertilize a portion of the eggs to keep the genetic pool healthy. And so it's really cool when you watch wild spawning take place and the way they select their own mates and all the dynamics of the challengers and the dominant guy and, you know, the way it all goes down. And so when we take that out of the equation, we're really doing the fish a disservice when if we think that we can manage them, you know, long term. So it's allowing them to have habitat where they can naturally do their thing, and that's really a big part of what's going to allow these animals to adapt in the future to, you know, changing conditions.
I love that, Mikey. That was just very poetic, man. That was like nature all right there, all wrapped up in one. That was like beautiful, man. You got in a zone there for a second.
I'm a fish nerd, man. I'm a total fish nerd. What can I say? I like catching fish. I like looking at fish. I like swimming with fish. I like just watching them do their thing. You know, big part of what I do now is just documenting fish being fish, you know. So I spend a lot more time swimming with them and photographing them underwater and trying to capture images of our native salmonids in their native habitat, you know, not just on the end of a line, but like really observing these animals. And that's what got me into fishing is, you know, there's all these beautiful fish swimming around, and California's native trout are like a treasure. Most of them are so phenomenally beautiful. They're like a beautiful painting. They have all these crazy intricate colors and the way they reflect light and glisten, but they really look the best when they're in their native habitat. And so I started fishing because otherwise you'd never get to interact with these fish. I'd catch them so that I could check them out, you know, well, look at how I admire this thing, and then let it go and let it swim back and live its life. And so to me, it's just as cool to swim with them now and be able to like photograph and film them underwater. And so what a cool job I have. I get to go out and like do that for work. I mean, come on, man, it's awesome.
It's so awesome. This is like romantic, man. Yeah. I love that. Well, good, guys. It's been so awesome to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show. Megan, the website one more time for our listeners?
Caltrout.org.
Caltrout.org. And I will put that in the show notes. So, guys, it's been great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.